This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Okay, so I invited Scott to teach with me tonight because tomorrow night he's starting a four-week series of teachings, and I wanted people here to hear him and me together, and that some of you might want to actually attend this four-week class series that he's doing. So I'll let him introduce the topic of the series, and then we'll both reflect on this core Buddhist teaching together.
Thanks. So basically the series is on the four seals, which in the Theravada tradition we call it the three marks or three characteristics. So these are fundamental kind of teaching of the Buddha, talking about the nature of impermanence related to our human experience, or anicca, and then dukkha, or the nature of suffering or dissatisfaction that we can't really avoid, yeah. And then anatta, which is working with how are we having a perception that's connected to how reality is, and what's a misperception, and understanding that through practice, through experience. So essentially, like, pretty much the Buddha Dharma can be really summed up in these three marks or three characteristics. It's also a way that Buddhism kind of defines itself as sort of principles of the tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, they just add on a fourth, which is just nirvana is beyond extreme. So this would be the sort of the attainment of nirvana beyond extremes of nihilism and eternalism. So they add that in the Mahayana tradition. But basically, these three, when we're fundamentally working with them, with the nature of impermanence, recognizing it in our life, also as we meditate, even when we're working with the breath or the body as an object of practice, we start to notice how things are not a continuity. Things are not a... They're made of many parts coming together. And of course, as we know, like, we're born and we have to die. So that's something that is a part of impermanent nature. But that's a very kind of, sometimes that's an intellectual experience as opposed to a lived experience. So really, anicca is meant to be experienced in our practice, and then working as a bridge to recognizing and working with the first noble truth, which is the second characteristic of knowing suffering. Yeah? Or knowing pain, or knowing dissatisfaction, in its many different forms. And so, and both of these lead as a bridge into understanding how the self is actually functioning. How are we, we're always in relationship with something. We're never not in relationship with something. But the Buddha was pointing out what kind of relationship creates more pain, creates more dissatisfaction and suffering, and what kind of relationship is going to be in line with, I don't like using the word well-being, but I'll use the word, we use the word liberation, generally. But what is it, what are we liberating from? And that's the fundamental question when we're talking about the third characteristic. But I'd really enjoy Noah kind of giving us a little bit more of an experiential feel of these, because these are meant to be experienced directly in the practice. If they're left as a conceptual thought, it doesn't really help us that much, yeah? So really, primarily, we're working with anicca in the beginning, recognizing the impermanent nature, recognizing the shifts as we sit with the body in the first foundation of mindfulness. And we, just as Noah described in our practice, watching, being with the experience in the body and watching the impermanent nature of that. Yeah? So that's the first step, and we work with that. And over time, what opens up is a relationship to knowing suffering in our life, but not in a way where it's like bringing us down, but in a way that's, we're able to recognize what's actually reliable and what's not reliable. And it's a tricky question, because I don't know how you guys find it, but I often feel, especially after a lot of years of Buddhist practice, I keep trying to put my foot on something to sort of prove to myself that I'm here and I'm permanent. And it's not like a thought, it's a feeling. But as soon as I put my foot down, some shit moves, and then I experience pain. I experience dissatisfaction. And so, for me personally, there's this relationship of sitting with anicca, that develops a lived experience where we put our foot down and yes, things change. And in one way, that's really good. So impermanence also, and Nietzsche has these two factors of, in one way, if shit didn't change, it would really suck. Like, it would be awful. You know, so sometimes things change and it changes for the good. You know, our shitty boss decides to quit. Like, or whatever happens or shifts in our life, yeah, to bring a positive change for us. So in one way, impermanence can work in our favor, yeah? But in another way, if we're constantly putting our foot on the ground that's moving and we're expecting the same result, we're expecting happiness from that, that's what the Buddha was fundamentally describing, yeah? So these are the fundamentals we work with in our practice, yeah?
I like to reflect on this because, as Scott said, in the Theravada, the way that I'm used to thinking about this is just the three characteristics, just that everything is impermanent. There's an unsatisfactory nature to both pleasure and pain because it's impermanent, and that so much of what we're experiencing is impersonal, is not self, it's just the human condition, it's just phenomena arising, coming together, and this, the way that this human mind, consciousness, memory, and form, perception, and feeling creates the feeling of I am. And so we all have the feeling of personal and I am, but it's just these factors of we remember who we were and we're feeling what's happening now, and we put those together and they say, we feel like I am the same person that has always existed, and we identify with that. But I like that in the Mahayana and Vajrayana tradition, this fourth seal brings into the teaching liberation, nirvana, in nibbana. And so I like to start there for a moment and reflect on that. What's being said here is that the end of suffering is possible for us in this lifetime. That it is an option, it is a possibility, there is the potential of relating to the normal human experience of mind and body and emotion without suffering about it. And I think that that's important, that enlightenment, nibbana, is not some magical state of constant bliss. It's not some other human experience of like, and then everything just was easy and joyful. It's just saying that it's possible to develop enough wisdom that we don't suffer about pain. It's not that pain goes away, but that we learn to meet pain with compassion, or that, as Analia was saying, that we're so mindful of the truth of pain that the heart starts to radiate compassion, that we train that we uncover that. Nibbana literally was a cooking term, I'm told, in India, and that what it means is to remove that which has been getting cooked. And so this is referring to the three causes of suffering, the three flames, the three ways that we get burnt, which is greed, clinging, craving, and attaching to pleasure. That burns us. Hatred, resenting, judging, fearing pain. That burns us. And self-centeredness, taking everything personal, clinging to self. That burns us. So nirvana literally means I'm not getting burnt by greed, hatred, and self-centered delusion anymore. I'm removing myself from the flame, I'm done cooking. Another way to look at nibbana is that I'm actually done cooking, and I'm going to chill out. Right? You've removed it from the fire, and you're cooling out. And so it's like, just, if you frame it that way, like, be cool. Right? Like, just be cool about the pain in your life. Just be cool about the impermanent pleasure in your life. Be relaxed about it. Chill out a little bit. Stop stressing. Stop suffering about this human condition. That's nibbana. Now, we think about it as this really lofty, full, permanent experience of liberation. Bhikkhu Bodhidasa, Buddhadasa, who was a Thai forest monk in southern Thailand, wrote a wonderful book and some articles about ordinary, everyday enlightenment. He said, what about all of those moments throughout the day when you're not attached to anything? When you're at ease? When you're not suffering? Did you have any moments today when you were not suffering? Or did you suffer all day long? You know, when you have a stressful day, you kind of look back and you're like, that day sucked. That was such a hard 24 hours. But if you really, especially if you're practicing mindfulness, and you look at, actually, there were some moments today where I wasn't in pain and I wasn't hating the pain, or I wasn't clinging to pleasure, or I had a nice nap, or whatever it was. There was some moments of not suffering today. So he said, part of this is bringing mindfulness. We're so hyper-focused on what's wrong. We forget to turn towards what's right. We forget to appreciate all of the moments in our life where there is nibbana, where we're not burning ourselves, where we're not suffering about pleasure or pain or taking it all personal. So I like that perspective, rather than nirvana as a lofty goal that you'll get to eventually, at the, you know, gradually with your decades of meditation, but remembering all of those moments throughout the day where you're not suffering, and trying to respond more and more like that, and saying, oh, what if I let go? What if I chill out a bit more about the pain in my life? What if I'm a little bit cooler around the pleasure, the lust, or the craving, whatever it is? What if I don't take the bait so often? Decreasing the suffering gradually. And even just saying it, this possibility that it's actually possible to not suffer. I think it's probably stupid of me to claim, but I'll do it anyways. Because when I reflect on the suffering of my life, and what that brought me to Buddhist meditation practice, I feel like I was suffering most of the time. Like, there was very little experience of not being self-obsessed, in craving, in hatred. It felt like it had become sort of my normal state pre-meditation, where there was very little ease. And after all of these years of meditation practice, I think it's decreased by about 90%. I still suffer sometimes, but now, I was talking to Scott earlier about this, now when I'm suffering, I'm like a little bit surprised by it. When it used to be just so normal, but now when I'm attached to something, I'm like, oh, that fucking hurts. Why am I doing that? And I know how to let it go. I've developed that ability over many years of practice, and become more sensitive to clinging to aversion. Like, oh, that hurts. I know how to not do that. And when I do it, I'm more quick to say, oh, I'm going to let go of that. That's not worth clinging to. So I like that what we're talking about here is the possibility of a greater sense of ease and happiness and not suffering. And that how we get there is by understanding directly that everything's impermanent. Everything, everyone, every experience that we have. Breaking the denial, the delusion, the hope. Give up, abandon hope that anything will be permanent in your life, and you'll suffer so much less. Abandon hope. Sometimes hope is a good thing, and sometimes it's just another delusion that we're holding on to. Could this just be different than reality? We see impermanence more and more clearly in our meditation practice, even just those preliminary, the breath. It arises, it passes. Each breath has a beginning, a middle, an end. Thoughts, that's even the most repetitive obsession. If you're mindful of it, you see it's arising, it's passing, it's gone, it's back. It's arising, it's passing, it's gone, it's back. It's still impermanent. It feels like, oh man, I've been in this resentment for hours. But if you're really mindful of it, you can't sustain any thought for hours. It appears, it passes, it comes back, and you're recycling that obsession. But it's not a permanent state of mind. So internal insights into impermanence, and then also acknowledging that it's true for both internal and external. nothing outside of us, nothing's going to last. I brought my lowrider into the mechanic again today, as you do with lowriders. And thinking about impermanence, both internal and external. And one of the ways that I really got this, the story from Ajahn Chah, when he was, you know, he was sort of criticized by some of his students, Ajahn Chah being my teacher's teacher, Jack Kornfield's teacher. And they said to him, they said, "You're teaching us about non-attachment, about how everything's impermanent, don't cling to anything." They said, "But you have your favorite drinking glass, and it looks like you kind of are coveting it, a little attached to your cup." Like, what a dick, right? To, like, give the monk a hard time about his glass. But anyways. Somebody said it. And Ajahn Chah took it seriously and said, he said, "You got me." Or something like that. He said, "I love this glass. This is my favorite glass, and it's mine. And I appreciate it. I like the way it holds my water, and I like the way that the sun is," like, he's in love with this glass. The sun hits it, and it sparkles in the crystal, and he's just, like, total intimate, passionate about this glass. He said, "But I appreciate every single moment with it, because I know that it's impermanent." Mm-hmm. He said, every moment I have with this, because I see this glass as already broken. I'm not attached to it. I appreciate it as an impermanent phenomena that I'm temporarily getting to have a relationship with. And I know that it will fall and break or dissolve, or, you know, that it's impermanent, and I'm not clinging to it. I'm appreciating it without attachment. It's already broken to me. I see it and all phenomena as impermanent. And so I said that because that teaching was important to me about 13 years ago when I had my 64 Impala in New York City, and it was my daily driver, and I had put airbag, you know, suspension in it. And the mechanics had it, as they often do. And they drove, and it dropped over one of those metal construction plates, and it tore the frame in half. And this is my prized possession. This is the thing that I always wanted, and I got. And when it got broken, I remember that already broken. Of course, material things break. Possessions get destroyed. Cars get scratched. Frames get torn in half. This happens. And so I won't claim that I didn't suffer at all. I suffered a little bit, but because of understanding impermanence, I didn't suffer that much about it. I said, of course, it's broken, and, you know, I can choose to fix it or not fix it. I chose to repair it. You can put new frames in old cars. My father took that teaching on impermanence. He said, "What if we related?" Scott talked about, we know impermanence around birth, aging, and death, right? That we are impermanent. So, what if you took that not only of turning towards your own mortality and impermanence, but towards everyone that you love, towards your children, towards your friends, towards your partners, and saw them as not already broken, but already dead? And really reflecting on the impermanence and the preciousness of cherishing and appreciating and being kind and loving and compassionate and forgiving because of the impermanence. So we don't know if we're ever going to talk again. We don't know if we have time to repair this relationship. We don't know if we have time to say thank you again sometime in the future. It may be an impermanent relationship. Somebody may never see them again. I was saying goodbye to one of my other teachers one time, Ajahn Amaro, and I was saying, you know, "I'll see you soon." And he said, "Stop." He said, "Tell me goodbye forever." Really, like, and as a teaching, and just like to stop the mind and say, just for, you know, like, maybe we'll see each other again, maybe not. So let's just say goodbye now with all of our heart, forever. Let's let go of the delusion that we can control things and that we're going to definitely see each other again. And let's just say goodbye forever. taking that level, and if we can really do, and it's hard, right? You don't want to do that for your, I don't want to do that for my children. I'm not going to say goodbye to my children forever, even though I'm aware that it's a possibility. And that we should all be aware that that's a possibility, with compassion, with appreciation, with cherishing the time that we have. It makes me a much more patient parent. It makes me a much more tolerant friend when I'm seeing through this lens. Nirvana being the end of suffering, dukkha, the term dukkha in Buddhism is used in two ways. It's used as the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. And then in this list, it's used in a different way, not as suffering, but dukkha as the unsatisfactory nature of all material things, sensations, things. No matter how much pleasure we get, how much abundance we experience, it does not satisfy us. We are born with a repetitive craving that no temporary pleasure is ever going to satisfy. Whatever happens, it's going to pass. And it's not going to be satisfactory. It's just going to be replaced with craving for the next success, for the next pleasure, for the next thing, the next fix. Happiness comes from no longer trying to find happiness in things, including sensual experiences, not just outside of us. Like most of us would say, yeah, I know, you can't buy happiness. I know it doesn't come from the stuff. But we think that maybe I can get to a place within me where I'll have bliss all of the time, or joy all of the time, or I'll feel good all of the time. It's impossible. The end of suffering comes from accepting the impermanent nature, the unsatisfactory nature of both pleasure and pain and neutrality. So I love this teaching. I think that it's so core, it's so liberating, it's so clear. It makes so much sense when you look at the human experience through this lens. Everything's impermanent. Everything's unsatisfactory. And so much of what we're experiencing is not personal, is not self. The other night I taught a little bit on the five daily reflections, where we would say to ourselves, I did it when I was critiquing the United States on the 4th of July, when I said, like, looked at sickness, aging, death, and personal responsibility of our country. But the five daily reflections, as turning towards ourselves and saying, I am the nature to age. I am the nature to become sick. I'm of the nature to die. I will be separated from all that I love. Grief, loss is natural, is unavoidable. Death is certain. The time of death, the time of loss is unknowable. And that my only true possession is my actions, is my karma. The only thing that we own, the only thing that we can really have, that we keep, if reincarnation is actually what's happening here, the only thing we take with us are karma, our actions in this lifetime. None of the stuff, none of the relationships, none of the sensations. And so I like that, because sometimes it confuses me when I think of, like, well, if everything's impersonal, what about my karma? We are the owners of our karma, and that's about it. It's the only thing that we really own. Everything else is borrowed. Everything else is on loan. Everything else, including this body, is impermanent. Something like that, right?
Oh, okay. I thought you were looking at me to say something. I got to say some shit after that.
Say some shit. You beatbox, I'll freestyle.
No, I'm down, man. I'm down. Good. Wu-Tang.
I'm happy to open it up if there's clarifications about this perspective. And again, everything that my sense is that this isn't, I'm not asking you to believe any of this. We are not asking you to have faith, but to reflect on it and just kind of look, does it make sense? Is this what your mind is like? Is this what your life is like? How would your life be different if you saw, you know, if you related to everything as already broken and everyone is already dead? You know, like, yeah. Is that too big? Is that too scary? Like, what would it make you a more loving person? Would you cherish and connect and forgive more quickly if you really understood impermanence? You know, to really reflect on it for yourself rather than saying, well, the Buddha said it, so it must be true. That's not how we roll. Please.
Yeah. Yeah, though, I mean, this is often overquoted, but I'll overquote it again. So there's a quote of the Buddha where he said in a certain sutra that you really have to treat my teachings like you would checking for gold. So I don't think most of us probably mine for gold, but you know, if you have, then you know, there's a process of rubbing it, putting it to fire, all these kinds of things in order to check if it's fool's gold or real gold. And the Buddha really emphasized that with his teachings. For me, this is probably the thing that I felt as a doorway for me, because it really had to become my lived experience, not the Buddha's experience, not Noah's experience, not my teacher's experience. It had to become my experience. And so, just as Noah's saying, like, we have to really look into these, and not just with our cognition. And that's why just the first foundation of mindfulness, of just being with the body, bringing mindfulness to the body, awareness to the body, can reveal so much. It seems so boring. I mean, I was extremely bored with that practice, I think, when I first started doing it. I was like, this sucks. I just want to go, like, study some, you know, intellectual stuff. You know, that's how my mind works and used to work a lot more. But this has become one of my heart practices, and I'm sure a lot of you in the room, because it seems so simple. But everything we're talking about, it actually starts to reveal. So this is a part of that gold rubbing. This is for us individually, right? And so as Noah said, like, you know, you don't have to believe any of this. And I think a problem comes culturally when we do believe it cognitively, but we haven't experienced it. And it's sort of like, it's there, but it's a little bit like, it's not alive. It's not moving. And the Buddha's teaching and these three marks are meant to be like move. Not just in our thinking mind, but in our body. And then nirvana, as Noah was talking about, is attainable. And we, through churning, through chewing on anicca, impermanence, through chewing on dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness within our lives in each moment, actually, through churning and chewing on this, we can come to a resolution. But that resolution of nibbana is an extinguishing or a putting out of both sort of, we're not going somewhere else. We're not going to some heaven or something like that. It's not extinguishing something so then we can have, like Noah said, have some great blissful experience. It's extinguishing something to get very normal. Like one teacher I had explained Buddhahood or nibbana as like, very normal, like almost like it's not boring, but it's also not special. It's not like exciting. And I think for a lot of years I had this feeling like, oh, how can I make my meditation more exciting? And it really made I wasted a lot of time, honestly. So these days I like to like share all of my shitty failings with people, so I'm in hope that other people can avoid them, you know. And really, it's quite simple. I mean, Noah and I were discussing today, too, just the simplicity of Buddhist practice. And, you know, I primarily train in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and I had to go through a doorway of a lot of, like, doing, a lot of cognitive things, and now I just like very simple practices. And so, depending on what you need, you might need stirring up sometimes, more simplicity sometimes, but at the end, it comes down to quite simple things. And the point being that Nibbana is not something outside of us either. It's inside. And we're uncovering that through practice. So I often view this quote of the Buddha of rubbing the gold as like, in a way, we think we have fool's gold and we're rubbing against it. So I could sort of use this quote in a different way, riff on it. in a way, we're rubbing that gold, but we're actually rubbing it, bringing out our own nibbana, right? So to me, this, like, the more I'm connecting with this as a practitioner, the more we start to see it in others. And that's where, as Noah was describing this beautiful thing, Analayo, right? Analayo said, of the heart opening, yeah?
And like
a curtain coming out. And this is our, like, actual nature. But this nature is not something, like, it's not a thing. And so, like, if we're looking for an experience of a thing, we're never going to be liberated. It's always going to be within the realms of happiness and suffering. Nirvana is beyond both extremes of happiness and suffering. And this is a tricky thing to get our heads around, because what is beyond happiness and suffering? So, but anyways, as we move through the practice and as we rub and chew against impermanence, with impermanence, chew on these things we're talking about in our body, in our experience, also thinking about them, chew on the unsatisfactory nature of when we're trying to place our foot, like I said earlier, on a ground that's constantly moving, but we're expecting it not to move. Yeah?
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.